Hello and welcome to Best Girl Grip, the podcast that celebrates the women behind the scenes of the British film industry. I'm your host, Nicole Davis. I wanted to start this podcast because it felt like there were lots of roles, be it in distribution, marketing, programming, post-production, or even on a film set, that don't get the attention they deserve. Likewise to the women doing those jobs. I'll be interviewing guests on how they got their start in the film industry, what it is they actually do, what keeps them motivated, and what their ambitions are. Hello, pod pals! I've made it to episode 3. Sorry, I'm shouting at you. I don't mean to. I'm just excited. It feels like a milestone, albeit a mini one, a mild pebble, if you will. For this episode, I sat down with Helen Simmons, a writer, producer, and agitator in the battle for diversity, inclusion, and gender equality in the industry to demystify the role of producing, particularly the belief that it isn't a creative job. She is one of Screen's stars of tomorrow and generally a bit of a wave maker. She's also great on Twitter, so you should follow her at HelenSimmons8. Plus, she has her own podcast called Rules for Life, which I recommend that you seek out. We talk about a whole bunch of things, from making her micro-budget feature Chubby Funny, why making commercial rom-coms shouldn't be looked down upon, her stint at the Weinstein Company, to child-raising whilst also rearing a film from the ground up, when she finds the time to write, and how failures are often mega useful. Helen was mind-blowingly practical and frank about her experiences in the industry, something for which I'm incredibly grateful, and I hope you enjoy the pod as much as I did hearing it firsthand. We kick off by talking about the BAFTA nominations, as they've just been announced the day we recorded this. Apologies in advance for the occasional sound issues, sirens and background office noises, and also for my weird ER tangent. What can I say? I'm a fan. This is episode 3 of the Best Girl Grip podcast.
Much talk about what we should be doing and what their values are, and then it's like never changes.
Well, especially it felt particularly incongruous because they did the when they did the announcements this morning.
Yeah. I'm just like, don't bother, just don't talk about it if you're not actually gonna do something
good on
the rider. Or there were films that could have maybe been. It's hard though because I know how it works, and if you haven't got the films of the right fame level, I guess, or recognition level, it's hard to break through, and we need to have more female directors too. But they should make an effort, that's the point.
I wonder as well if distributors back one pony, and if they have one that they really think is going to succeed, whether they put all their eggs in that basket.
I feel like this year, other than The Favourite, which I've not seen, there's not been, I wasn't like a fan of Star Is Born, and I just feel like there's not much I'm excited about.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, exactly. Apart from maybe like Roma, Cold War.
Roma, I loved it.
I have
that's
issues with the kind of foreign,
exactly,
not crossing over to the best film category.
And apart from Beast is great.
Yeah,
brilliant that that's got 2 nominations.
Mm-hmm.
Really excited for Lauren. Yeah, otherwise, I feel like even in the British category,
they're
just massive movies that aren't really that British.
Yeah, it doesn't
that's
feel like it has a strong identity, that category, anymore. Yeah, as you said, I feel like it's happening, but I'm not that fussed about it this year, which is unfortunate.
What an
issue. I think Best Actress is probably the most heated and exciting, actually.
Yeah, who's that again? Glenn Close
for The Wife.
Olivia
Colman. Surprised none for Viola Davis for Widows, actually, considering
that's the only one for Widows, right?
Yeah, considering it's been shut out. And actually, a lot of critics have kind of been backing Elizabeth Debicki to get one for Best Supporting. Lady Gaga for Star Is Born.
Yeah. Melissa McCarthy didn't get any.
Oh, yeah.
Did she?
Yeah. You've hit the nail on that. Yeah, that's the other.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I need to see that. I loved her first film, Diary of a Teenage Girl.
She's cool, and she's just done another one, hasn't she, with Tom Hanks, what she's doing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's really heartening, because often there's like such a massive gap between when a director kind of their first or second, or even their second or third. And you saw it with Deborah Granite, it's just sort of like a 7-8 year wait.
Yeah.
And you're like, where's the letdown? Is it someone, like, where does the hype go once we percolate around these women? And then
standards as well, isn't it? It's like, what was it I read recently about the guy who's done 3 films with Mark Wahlberg?
Peter Berg?
Is that his name?
I think, yeah.
He's done 3 films, which are basically
Boston
flops. Boston Marathon
one.
Three flops in a row.
Yeah.
Still keeps getting massive budgets. And like, can you imagine, even if you've got like a middling reviewed film as a female director, you basically just have to have like outstanding hit.
Yeah. an Oscar-nominated picture to then to secure going. The backing.
And afterwards. Even then it's like...
But yeah, we let an end fail time and time again and still have the trust that...
Yeah, that they'll somehow just put it out the back.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was the first thing that we think about. But anyway, thank you for joining me today. Let's kick off with kind of what your role is now and perhaps a sort of pressie of how you got there.
So I am... So far I've predominantly been producing, but I've started doing writing as well. And so now I kind of am doing them both equally. I studied history at Cambridge and I thought I would be a lawyer or maybe go into politics or something like that.
Something that wasn't film.
But I'd always loved films. Mm-hmm. And when I was little I thought I want to be a film director.
So you knew the role existed in kind of even your consciousness?
Yeah. I never took it seriously.
Right.
Because I didn't have, there's no one I know, there's no one in my family or family friends that I'd seen do it. I think the closest I'd got to a filmy person was like someone in my school was Rupert Grint's sister. So I'm like tenuous link to something in film. So I had no idea of how you might get into that. But then in my second year of university, I heard about this film festival called Water Sprite, which had been set up, I think it had been set up in like 2008, but it started quite small. It was started by a group of students before I was at university, and it started this small thing that they'd do in a couple of basement rooms in the university,
right.
Gathering people that cared about film. And then it started to grow, and I joined in my second year just doing, I did like some photography for it, and I helped with events, and I just sort of got involved a little bit. And then, kind of out of nowhere, I didn't expect to be offered the job that I was offered with my friend Julia to run it for my final year of university. And it just became the best thing ever. And it was like, obviously we're doing it alongside finals, but there was such an exciting energy to doing that. And then I discovered that actually all of those skills were basically producing.
Right.
As in, you know, you're raising money for something, dealing with agents to get to help. We actually had Olivia Colman speak that year, we had Eddie Redmayne, we had Neil Gaiman. And managing a team, there was like a team of 40 people, so I was producing with a crew. And Hilary Bevan-Jones, who is a producer, she was the patron of it, so she was kind of guiding us. So the whole sort of year of putting that festival together and then actually running it, I mean, obviously there was also the short film side.
Yeah.
So we had short films.
Selecting as well as kind of, you're doing the whole umbrella.
Yeah, exactly. And there were student short films. Mm. I think we had them from 40-odd countries.
Wow.
And then we had a bursary to fly them over. And one of the film that won everything that year was directed by Nick Rowland, who's done his debut.
Yes.
And actually he met Joe Cole, the actor, at the festival.
Okay.
And they went on to do Slap, which was BAFTA nominated.
Right.
And so there was lots of things that you could see kind of in the coming years after had grown there. And you know, I met Will McGregor, who's just directed a film called Gwen.
Yes,
I made at TIFF. So Hilary produced that, and
right.
The festival was actually renamed after like 3 years after his short film stormed it. So there was kind of all these connections that were suddenly there through this festival. And I thought, well, maybe now I know people in film, it would be worth having a go. So that was kind of what planted it in my mind and what made me look into producing more, having met Hilary.
So why producing in terms of film as opposed to running a film festival after having that experience? What spoke to you about that role?
I have a passion for films, not necessarily film festivals. What I wanted was to be involved in a project from start to finish. I guess I didn't really know exactly... I still definitely was open to all sorts of things. And I think it was more like, you know, maybe I want to be in development or maybe I want to be on the floor. Like I knew that producing was something that might come naturally having done that, but I didn't know yet because I hadn't done anything.
So how did you go about it?
I did a short film with a wonderful, well, now a wonderfully successful producer called Zora Bacon, who did a short called Man Boys. We did this little thing together, also with an actor who's now going to about to be huge, called Jonah Howard King, which was absolutely atrocious. And we actually fell out in the making of the short film.
Oh, wow.
And we became friends again like 2 years ago. But we tried to make a short, which didn't go to plan. We never released it because it was abysmal. But I then started to just try and make short film. At the same time as I started off doing some internships. So there was a lot of luck involved. An exec from Film 4 had heard about the festival and was in development for the Riot Club. And he got in touch and said, this might be a bit strange, but would you be interested in doing some development because you've experienced Cambridge and you know about film? So I was like, yeah, of course. So then I met Lona, and I met Laura Wade, and I met Pete Shaneen and that team. And so through that, then they got me an internship at the Weinstein Company,
okay.
Which was an experience for a few months.
Good experience? It was a different one.
Yeah, it wasn't, it wasn't. I mean, I didn't have any real experience with all the horrible things that went on. I mean, I did a bit in hindsight. I was sent to Marrakesh with 3 hours notice one morning to bring him his wallet because he'd left it in London, and spent the day just in a hotel in Marrakesh, and I sort of saw the assistants ferrying people in that hotel rooms and stuff, but I didn't really know what was going on, and we were well protected in the London office by the people that worked there. But the thing it really sort of brought up that I experienced was like that high level intensity of, because it was around the time of the awards and awards campaigns, so this was 2014, and you know, I got to go to the BAFTA after party that they threw, mm. and like see all the stuff that went into that, and like Harvey would be in town a lot doing screenings to try and encourage things, and I got to do loads of script reading and learn how to do that, but also saw, you know, his awful behaviour and
right.
in the non-predatory sense, but just purely being, you know, aggressive towards people. Yeah, just like embarrassing staff in front of other people. Yeah.
Culture of fear as opposed to encouragement.
Yeah, and how a company probably shouldn't be run, in that it was so dictatorship in a way, in that like he made a decision everyone followed. Mm. The execs didn't seem to have that much power, and it was all very, it didn't feel necessarily that professional at times. But that was interesting, and then I was a director's assistant on a film I did, called Tulip Fever.
And did they come in quite quick succession, sort of you were building up contacts?
Yeah.
So you've sort of always sustained a career in film?
Pretty much. So I was, so at this point, so my parents had said, they don't live in London, they said to me, you can live at home for a year. And so, and I actually managed to get this job on Tulip Fever, I would say 6 or 9 months into that, I can't remember. So I got this job, which was in Pinewood, and that taught me, that was also interesting to see again how a massive film set works, but I definitely didn't like being an assistant.
What exactly, what kind of things are you doing as an assistant? Is it quite a lot of grunt work?
It's a lot of grunt work. It's a lot, you know, you have to know when somebody might want a tea or coffee, and as someone who doesn't drink tea or coffee, I found that quite weird, or like, I don't know, someone once said to me that if you're a producer, it's because you're unemployable. Not in a bad way, but in the way that you need to be in charge. And for a long time, I sort of felt ashamed of that, do I think I'm better than this job? And it was definitely not, I thought I was better than the job, and I tried to learn as much as I could. But I think having gone from a very intense university experience that I've worked really, really hard to get to, and the sort of workload of that, which is, you know, you're reading 8 or 10 books a week, you're like churning out essays, you're very stimulated, to go to a job where most of the time you're kind of sat around waiting, I found really hard. So, but again, that was interesting. And I really loved the camaraderie of set, and how that taught me 100% how what everybody did on the set. And I understood the pre-production process, and I just got a better understanding of sets. And so after that, I was like, right, well, that's not, I don't want to go up the working your way up path.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what I want to do. So the only other option is to, I couldn't afford to go to film school, so the only other option was to make things and sustain my life another way. So I joined a diary service called Call Time. They would call you up and be like, right, can you go and do 3 days on Broadchurch as a runner or as a location marshal? So it wasn't like what I found very demoralising of, you know, Monday to Friday doing something you didn't enjoy. It was like short, sharp bursts on different productions.
Yeah.
You got to make friends.
Yeah.
I didn't mind the running, actually. It's an active thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's always something to be doing. You're taking it all in. So I did that and did like days on all sorts of things. And sometimes it was a reality TV show and you were like location marshal in a field. And other days you were, you know, doing Broadchurch or Legend or Called Midwife, you know, various things like that. I was doing that. Also doing tutoring, history tutoring to make money and trying to make short films.
So yeah, you're having to juggle money in terms of making ends meet. And does Call Time still exist? Is that
two women. Yeah, I think it's doing really well.
Oh, brilliant!
Because people always need just bodies for a few days
here. Because it's such an unreliable means of work. Coming back to the first short film that you produced with Sora Heard, I have a friend called Sorsha, and I always get those two pronunciations mixed up. It's interesting to me that you call that a failure, and I wondered, has failure taught you as much about what to do as some successes have?
Definitely. It was a failure in the sense that there was no film to do anything with at the end of it. But I think, you know, we all learn huge lessons, and I think you definitely learn, you can learn more about yourself when you find out what you don't like or what you're not good at than, you know, when everything's going breezy. you can kind of get a bit complacent, yeah. I think, and just be like, well, this is easy, or, you know. So, definitely. And I think, like you say, it's not, it's a failure only if you let it be a failure. And I think there's definitely been loads of points where I could have been like, this, like, you know.
Yeah, I fucked up.
Yeah, I should do something else. But it's always been the thing. The way I've tried to see everything is that it's always just, everything's kind of stepping stone to the next thing. And that doesn't mean that there's not loads of value in each thing. And every time you're working on a project, that's your main focus and it's your everything. But if it's not perfect, or it doesn't go exactly as planned, or it doesn't have the reception that you wanted, you've still done the huge feat of making it. And
that's
hopefully the next one.
Celebrated. When did you allow yourself the realisation that you're good at producing?
I've made a few shorts. And again, also was learning at this point who I wanted to work with in terms of personalities of directors and the type of genre that I liked. And I don't know, I hate to say fell into it because I didn't fall into it, but it just seemed to fit my skill set, my personality. I did try directing a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
The first time, we didn't really do anything with it. And then that one, that we actually, the first time we shot it, it was okay. And then our editor lost all the footage, so we had to reshoot.
Oh my gosh, how does that happen?
They just didn't back up.
Oh no.
Always back up your hard drives. Rule number one. So we had to kind of reenact it over to it. You've lost all the,
yeah,
you know,
the spontaneity.
But I discovered that, and this might change, you know, always open to things changing, but I just realised that I'm quite short-tempered. My attention span is jumpy and I like to have loads of things on the go at once, and I don't like to be... I've got a big picture view rather than like getting into the minutiae, and directing is very much about tunnel vision and, like, you know, the intricacies of performance and the shot specificities and, you know, and I just didn't care for that. It's something that I can really appreciate in other people's work. You know, increasingly I'm like, well, maybe in 10 years' time, maybe if there was the right project, then maybe I'd want to try it again. But when I, at that point, having done them, I was like, that's not really, it's not giving me energy, it's draining me, and actually I'd probably be much more comfortable just being a producer.
What makes a good producer?
I think you have to be an eternal optimist. My boyfriend said to me the other day that, because I'm always late, he'd read something where, it's not an excuse for being late, but that people that are late tend to just be really optimistic about managing their time. So they will think that they can accomplish, you know, three things in their time when really they should only accomplish one. And I think with film you have to be optimistic, because if you were realistic, you would never do anything. Like, the odds are always stacked against you. It's always hard to get the right cast. It's always hard to even find that script in the first place, and then to finance it, and then for the shoot to go okay, and for then it to actually be good, and for it to make money. You know, all of these, there's just constant hurdles. And it always goes wrong. So you just have to be optimistic and think, well, we'll get over that and we'll fix it. So I think you have to be, yeah, you have to be optimistic, you have to be a problem solver, and not see problems as the end of the world, because they're always there. And I think you have to be a certain sort of leadership quality in that you set the tone a lot of the time, you rally the troops. A lot of what your job is on a set, I found, you know, you've spent months and months doing all your legal closing, your finance raising and your deals and your creative chats with your director and DOP and stuff. And then when you're on the set, you're like a therapist.
That's interesting you say that, because you just said you have to set the tone. Do you watch ER?
No, I don't.
So basically, it's obviously set in an American emergency room, and one of the main, I can't think what they're called, but like the chief of staff who kind of like runs all the doctors, one of the characters says to the other as he like passes the mantle on him, "You now set the tone." And it kind of reminds me of that, like, you know, there's always going to be an emergency, there's always going to be something like a new trauma coming in that you have to deal with.
You know? No, it's true. And because your director, I think they shouldn't be allowed to be as kind of, oh, I'm a brooding creative so I can act badly, because I think that's rubbish. And there's lots of people that can be incredible creatives and not act badly. So it's not that, but, you know, they have to become very quite into themselves and into their own heads and focusing on what's in front of them most of the day. So it's your responsibility to look outward and make sure everyone else is happy.
To see the bigger picture.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you have to enjoy that and not be too... Probably you have to be extroverted. You can't be drained by people, because they're always going to be around. And I think be calm. You know, you're allowed to have your stressful moments, and I have. I don't think you should... Yeah, you shouldn't show it. I think you need to be someone who can handle, you know, an actor screaming at you and an exec threatening to pull out or whatever it is, and you not be fazed, which is a skill you learn, but I think you have to have the disposition to cope with that.
So how do you strike that fine line of not internalising the stress, but also not projecting it outward.
It's hard. You have to... I think the thing that actually helped me the most was having a baby, because suddenly, you know, my stresses on the film set were not as important as they were before. I think if your career is your identity in your life, very easy for everything to, like, be a dagger when it goes badly. So I've definitely found... God, this is not a tip for everyone to go and have a child, you know, or whether it's a pet or, you know, or your friends, or but just not...
To have something outside of it.
Yeah, not being like, this is all I've got, because then it's... pressure's way too high. And also being, and I didn't used to be very good at this, but doing a bit of enforced downtime and saying, do you know what, if it's not fixed by 11 p.m. it's not going to be fixed until tomorrow, so just have a bath and go to bed, or taking weekends off but actually taking them off. And I'm not always good at that, but I think it's something you have to cultivate, because otherwise you're going mad.
And I guess with a child, that you
have to give them your attention.
Was there someone whose career you look to as something you want to emulate, or someone who acted as sort of a mentor to you in your early days?
It changed all the time, but there's lots of people. So in terms of a mentor, Andy Stark was really great at first, because I worked on a film he did with Steve Oram called R, and I was just a runner on it, and that was done for no money at all over 2 weeks in Steve's house. And I just, I realised that you don't need to have all of the, like, he didn't even have first AD or second AD, you know. They just did it. And then I went to Andy for advice quite often, and he was like, well, you know, they did Down Terrace for less than 10 grand or something. And he was like, just do it. And he was like, if we'd have waited for £1 million, we would never have made any. And he was like, you need to keep the power with you rather than with the funders. As in, we've got a project, we're making it. Whatever happens, do you want to jump on? Yeah. Rather than going around cup in hand, like,
I need you.
I need you, otherwise I'm never going to make anything. So that was 100% the ethos behind Chubby Funny. We said, we decided to make it in October 2014. And we said a year to the day we would start filming, regardless of how much money we had. So that was the approach that I definitely got from him. And then, you know, he sent me my first ever template for a budget and answered questions I had about various things. So he was very influential. He's really great. And has a no-nonsense attitude to film. He doesn't kind of get swept up in things.
What was the experience of producing Chubby Funny like? That was your first feature?
Yes. Yeah. It was good. Mm-hmm. Do you know what? Compared to the feature we just did, which was a lot bigger budget-wise, it was actually quite calm. I mean, looking back at it now, it wasn't. But when you don't have any money, you don't have as many pressures.
Yeah, I guess less choice maybe as well.
It's almost like having no money is like having endless money, because... when you have some money, everybody wants it. And everybody thinks that they deserve a bigger chunk of it, or that you're trying to take them for a ride. So the budget kind of seems to be to go less far than when you have nothing, because everything's a favour and everybody's in the same boat of understanding that there's no money. So in that sense, it was actually really lovely. But it also wasn't as formal a process as how I have to do things now. So we didn't have like a... all the formal legal closings, and you know, there were no big companies involved, and the crew was really small. Most of the actors were just friends.
And were you a full-time producer at that point?
After I'd done a few shorts, like 4 or 5 shorts, I was introduced to a company called AIM Image in Camden. The guy who runs it, Ahmed, is my guardian angel, basically. He knew Harry, the director of Chubby Funny, and we met, and he wanted to come on board Chubby, and then he's always kind of had somebody doing film stuff there, and he said, did I want to be that person, because the guy that's working for is going to another country. And I said yes, but I've got all these things I want to do, and I want to still be able to do them. I'll take you along for the ride with those projects if you support me, kind of thing. So then he and still does give me an office in Camden, and supported me with a kind of retainer salary there. I was never really working for him. It's more of a like, and especially now we have an almost like even more slightly different setup, but he's kind of just invested in me, and in return I will involve him as an exec producer on projects and try and pay back through films. And he's like my shareholder in me as a producer, I guess. Yeah.
How do you prioritise your time?
I tend to, when things are really busy, it's what needs to be done by tomorrow. Which isn't necessarily a good way to be, but it works.
Yeah.
When things are calmer, like they are now, I just try to prioritise 3 things, really. Actual deadlines. You know, we've got a film we're trying to shoot in May, so there's a certain timeline that we have to follow if we want to make it happen. Then there's the financial aspect, so it's which project is most likely to go and pay and be a big enough budget to, you know, prioritise. And then it's the kind of creative, career, personal fulfilment thing of which writing started out as, if I don't just give it a go, like, I'll never do it. But now has become, actually, it's one of my deadlines for projects, so it has to be prioritised. So I try to just be like, this week, or I love lists. I just have lists coming out of my eyes, and, you know, just doing a list for what I want to do that week or what I need to do the next day, and just go. There's no real serious method behind it other than just trying to keep afloat and...
Yeah, whatever works for you.
Yeah.
You also mentioned that you're a mother now.
Yes.
Do you feel like the industry supports you enough in that role?
I do and I don't. I mean, things like Raising Films, brilliant initiatives. And I think the more... It's interesting, actually, because the more actresses who have power and clout become mothers themselves and they speak out about it and it gets talked about more. Kerry Mulligan and Keira Knightley and everyone have been talking about it recently. But, as an actress, you've got your trailer and you can have your nanny there. And it's not easy, but it's kind of easier. I think it's the discrimination that is not necessarily always overt, but it's definitely there. And we're just still, and this is not just a film thing, this is everywhere, you know, we're still in that mindset of, if you're a woman with a child, you're not going to be as present or you're not going to be as available, that a father is never seen in that light. You know, when would you ever ask it? I read something recently about a female director not getting a TV job because they said something about her not being able to travel as much. Or, you know, there's just such a double standard there.
And before, is the assumption before even allowing them to show up on set and prove that they can be there?
Yeah. And I've definitely had my fair share of that, of men thinking, well, you're not going to be able to do your job now. And I've definitely proved that wrong. But then I'm also lucky that I have a really supportive partner who can do lots of childcare. Because we couldn't afford a nanny or a nursery. And our parents babysit, but, you know, they don't live in London. That's a huge thing.
Yeah, it's not the infrastructural, it's still a very personal support network.
And also just the freedom that I have, because I'm in charge of my own time and my own boss, and because Ahmed's really chill and lovely, you know, for the first sort of year of his life, I would bring him to the office with me a lot. Then when we were up in Yorkshire doing this film at the beginning of last year, he would be in the production office quite a bit, come to set sometimes. And it's a bit harder now that he's two because, you know, he's running around.
Yeah. All vocal
problems. Yeah.
How important are things like, I know you're part of BFI's network.
Yes.
How important are things like that to a producer? Because it can maybe feel quite lonely sometimes or isolating if you've kind of got tunnel vision on one project.
I think producers are, I think we are actually really good at connecting with each other because we have to be. There's a big group of us at the moment that have formed a kind of round table to try and make change.
Lauren Dunn,
Sophie Reynolds.
Yeah. So, if you wouldn't mind talking a bit about that as well, I'd be interested to know what your initiative there is and what you do.
Well, it started because I was having a battle with a financier that didn't actually end up coming on the film, but trying to hold back my fee. And I was trying to explain that my partner was going to have to leave work to come and look after our son while we shot this film, and I couldn't not have my fee because otherwise I couldn't make the movie.
Yeah.
And I was complaining to Sophie about this because she's a friend that I've met. We met cleaning floors on a film. and she was at the same time talking to Lauren, who was complaining because she had some development funding and they weren't letting her take more than, I think, like £1,500 or something, and that also had to include legals, and it was all just very frustrating. Yeah. So she was like, well, we should all meet and talk about this, and we thought, well, we can't be the only ones with these issues. Mm-hmm. Shall we see if there's any interest in talking about it? We did a first session, and like 30-odd people turned up. And
to air their concerns?
Yeah, it was just a rant session, to be honest. And then at the end, we said, we can rant, fine, but now we need to do something about it, because there's no point moaning if we're not going to try and change it. And then it kind of morphed into this thing where there were loads of us who all felt the same, and the issues kind of, we could narrow down to 5 or 6 things, and the solutions that we thought were there, we started to find, and we started talking to PACT, who were really keen to help, and BSAC, and then when we did a survey of 150 producers to kind of work out where things were at with them in terms of their concerns, but also how much money they're making versus how much work they're doing and how slow it is to make a living. The key issue being that there seems to be an assumption of producers that they have money, which is not true. You know, to be a producer, firstly, you don't, your career doesn't take off in the same way as a writer or director or an actor. If you have one hit, then suddenly you're swooped in by the bigger companies and pay loads of money and you have your agent fighting for you. As a producer, you don't get that and you're kind of back at square one each time. You have to be self-sufficient. As a producer, you also have all the overheads. So, you know, a writer has to write, but if a producer's actually going to make something happen, they have to pay for the legals, they have to cover all overheads if there are any. They basically everything falls on them, all the responsibility,
yeah.
And there's a lot of time which is harder to quantify than if you're like, write me three drafts of a script. There's that whole, you know, the whole period, also you're very involved with the writer, but, and especially if they're a new writer, but financing it, casting it, putting it together, crewing it, like all of that, which often takes a couple of years, if not more. And that's basically free labour. For then there to be an attitude that, oh, well, we can't, how could we ever give more than £2,000 to a producer for their 2 years of work?
Unsustainable, unfeasible.
Yeah, and all it does is make a much worse diversity problem because you're essentially saying the only people who can produce come from a lot of money and don't need to earn money from their producing work, so it should be a hobby. Or you're expecting them to also hold down plenty of other jobs, in which case it's so hard to progress your career. And you're looking at, I mean, if you were to, I think we actually did this just as an experiment, but if you were to write down all of the successful producers working in the UK right now, not of our kind of emerging level, but the ones who are in their 50s, 60s, way over half of them are white men who've gone to public school. If you don't actually enact some change in terms of people making it sustainable for people to do, you're never going to change the diversity of producers. And by the same token, you're not actually going to find those voices that you say you want to champion. Mm-hmm. Because are they going to connect with this guy who went to Eton if they're from a council estate in Sheffield?
Yeah. And in a way, because producers are the ones that kind of have got that bigger picture and have got that overview, it's almost them that it kind of has to start with. And
100%.
Because they're the ones that are going to go out. Yeah.
Yeah. And also the other thing that we take issue with is the perception of producing as not being a talent worth harnessing or respecting. You know, lots of people upset about development execs going around them to talk to their director or writer and just
shutting them out.
So there feels like there's a lot of work to be done, but everybody, all the public funders have been very open to it. For a producer, a lot of it is you really have to know your stuff. You have to learn it, and actually making five shorts is not going to teach you how to make a feature. It's just not. And so if you can't afford to go to the NFTS, how do you train producers? How, you know, that's a massive aspect too, because they're kind of neglected. And you know, there's so many problems within the industry generally, and about making the industry sustainable. You know, films have to make money, have to be making the right films that sell, and all of that. But I think if you can create a really healthy, sustainable business side to film over here, not just focusing on those that are well established, but on who's going to take their place, then that's a good place to start.
With that in mind, because that sounds like quite a big burden to bear, what motivates you?
I think my personality is very driven by, like we were saying, about the things you don't want to do. So, like, do you know Myers-Briggs? I did that. My dad told me about that, and I did it once, where it's like 22, Lauren's obsessed with it as well. You do this big quiz, and it's sort of like your instinct answers, and it tells you you're one of 22 types, which is four different letters. And the one I am...
Definitely going to be taking that as something.
Yeah, I'm an ENTJ, which is like, essentially, you need to be in charge. That's like... It's the only way you can function.
Okay. So there are like meanings ascribed to each letter.
Yes. Okay. Like E is extroverted, N is intuitive, there's judging, and there's all different things. Okay. And then it explains your personality.
Right.
I do believe in star signs, but anyway, so I think the idea of being stuck in a job that I'm not in control of my own destiny and I'm chained to a desk doing something I don't want to do fills me with horror. So that has always been a big motivator, to be able to be in charge of what I do, to work with people I want to work with, to have my own time and hours, and because I know that's how I function best. So I've always, and like I said, I'm quite impatient. So I think I said short temper earlier, when actually I meant I'm impatient. But I didn't want to wait. That's why we did Chubby Funny. It was like, I want to make stuff. I don't want to wait around.
Yeah, for permission.
Yeah, the quicker I can get onto this, you know, ladder, the better. And then, you know, we all want to make some money and go to the fancy awards ceremonies, and like anybody says they don't want to win an Oscar is a liar, frankly. So there is that element, but I think it is just, I love what I do and I want to be allowed to constantly do that. Finding the stories that you want to tell. I'm very strict because it's bitten me a few times with now only ever coming on a project that I really, really love. It's got to be that I would, you know, really hate myself if I didn't make it. You know, I'd really regret it. Rather than just being like, it's okay. Like, I have to be so passionate. Because the amount of energy and time you put into it.
You have to really want to do it.
It's more about saying, I've got a project and I'm going to make it and I'm going to adjust my expectations and the type of, or the way I make the film based on what I can actually get for it at that point. Because lots of scripts, I genuinely believe there are like four versions of each script. So if you are Yorgos Lanthimos and it's your sixth film, then that script is going to be, you know, $30 million and will star Emma Stone, or because that's where you're at and that's the film you can make, and you can make it luscious and you can shoot it on film and you can do whatever you want.
I would have loved to have read the version that was in development.
Yeah, 12 years ago. So that's the dream scenario when you're there, brilliant. Then I think there's lots of other tiers and you just have to work out where, it's actually less probably you as a producer and more working out where your director's at, because that's what attracts the cast, that's what attracts the money. Even though, you know, we are still in film, unlike TV, very director-driven. So it's about working out where, if you're making a debut, you need to think, okay, probably, unless I've made an Oscar-nominated or BAFTA-nominated short, and, you know, everyone's queuing up to work with me, I'm probably not going to be able to make this for more than, well, I'm definitely not going to be able to make this for more than $1 million, let's be realistic, or around that mark. But if you're not one of the chosen few for those nominations or from various schemes or whatever, then it's probably less than $500,000. And if you're not in with the right people, public funders and things, which is hard to be when you're starting out, quite rightly, you've got to prove yourself, you're talking 150 or less. So it's about then saying, okay, firstly, can I actually physically make this movie? It's a period film with a gazillion extras and horses and costume. No, you can't. So shelf that script and find a script that you can make. If you can make it, then it's how can I make the best version of it with the money that I have. And so with the first one, we went out to, I literally just went around everyone I knew and I was like, do you have any friends who are bankers or who are, you know, people that aren't in film but have a creative itch that they need to scratch? Because when you're going to private money, you're basically going for their 5% risk capital. So they've made lots of sensible investments and then they invest in a film because, not because they're guaranteed a return or a profit, and they know that, but because it's a really fun thing to do and they can go to a premiere and they can tell all their friends at lunch that they're making a movie. They're different, they have different expectations and needs to, say, a public funder, because it's more about making experience really fun for them and teaching them as you go. And obviously everybody wants film to make money and make return, so that is an aspect to it, but it's not the primary one. So that, and that was a tiny budget. It started off as 40 grand and it went up to 60, but it, you know, pennies still, compared to. Yeah. And then with the one we just did, we had some money from Screen Yorkshire, we had some Belgian money from New Media. And then again, I still had to get lots of equity from different sources in various, you know, varying levels of. It's, you have to have a lot of hustle and like just not take no for an answer and not give up, because like I say, it's, if you stopped at the first no, or the first 25 no's, you will never make it. So, and then again, you know, we did the same thing of, okay, we'll try and get Emma Thompson. She'll probably say no. She did say no. We'll you know, we, and then you just kind of figure out from the responses you're getting, okay, he's, so for Harry, for this film, you know, he had buzz from his first, so that helped us. You know, we seemed like a legit project, but he wasn't an Oscar nominee, or, you know, he wasn't Damien Chazelle. So you're not going to get top, you know, A-list talent. It's just not realistic. So then you work out, okay, who do we really, really want, and who in that list is kind of the best to satisfy our sales agent that we could sell the film? And you kind of then just see who is biting and who's interested. And then based on the cast that you get, that sets your budget, or your top level of the budget, and then it's how much you can raise. And so we didn't have enough, really. You know, it was an ambitious script, loads of locations and lots of extras and things. So it was about being quite brutal. And I think as a director, you have to be, until you're a top director, you just have to be quite flexible and accepting of the fact that money doesn't grow on trees for you, yeah. But I think you have to, what we did with Chubby, I'm so glad we started that way rather than starting on a big budget, because you know that you can create things on nothing. You can make the impossible possible, so you don't go in thinking, oh, well, I definitely need £50,000 for this thing. You know, you think, oh, how could we do it another way? And you use the restraints as a creative thing.
At this point, I ask Helen about the new production company that she's set up called Erebus Pictures. I decided to interject because I, A, mispronounced it, and also the sound got a little bit funky. So yeah, let's rejoin the recording now.
I ran it with Stephanie Aspin, who I was at university with, and we did some theatre there. Sort of known ever since we left that we wanted to do a film production company, but I went and did this kind of grassroots, just making thing approach. And she worked, she did a really cool MA at the V&A, and then she worked on Fantastic Beasts with David Yates, wow. So she was his assistant. And so she saw the huge side of movie making. And we'd sort of been brewing the production company, and then we sort of started to gather a few projects. So they've been in the works for a year or two, some of them. And we made a couple of shorts to kind of
test the waters.
Yeah, test the waters on things. Yeah, we've got enough now on our slate. Stuff that's hopefully going to shoot this year, next year. We're both, so Steph's a writer as well. She's writing this television show for Benedict Cumberbatch. It's really cool. So yeah, we're both kind of at the stage where we feel like lots of our features are ready to go, and we're trying to do some TV as well. But the main thing is we want to make commercial stuff. Like, I don't think it's sustainable to just make small British art house movies. It's just, we want to make stuff that travels, we want to make stuff that's commercial, not see that as a dirty word. We want to make comedies and rom-coms and thrillers. And
almost bringing back a mid-budget film.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
In those 90s films. Yeah. And to build a brand together, and for me, having produced solo, which is a really quite tough experience to not do that again and to produce with someone else, because even if you know the responsibilities and the stresses don't change, at least you're sharing them with someone else. I think the hardest thing is to feel like you and only you are carrying the burden of the film collapsing, you know, because that's the hardest thing I think about producing is the sheer responsibility. And you know, you might have 10 execs, but they don't actually have that burden at all, and your director doesn't. And as soon as things start to become, that's the thing I always find hardest, when things start to become real, when you're starting to hire people, you're starting to put together, and obviously finance is always precarious until the last minute, you start to realise, wow, this is people's livelihoods, this is people's career. You've got your crew, you've got your financiers, you've got your agents of your cast, you've got so many people, and like ultimately the buck stops with you and everything. And I think that's a lot to handle.
What kind of stories do you like to tell?
Well, I've done two comedies now. I mean, they both had an edge of darkness to them. This, the Ilkley, even more so. I tend to, my yardstick is basically, would I watch this and would I watch it more than once? Because firstly, you will watch your film so many times that if you don't like it, it's going to be awful.
Yeah, screwed.
So, and not trying to pretend to like something because I think it should be, you know, like, should I like it? Does it feel like it's a work? You know, just literally, do I connect with it on a very basic level? And is it entertaining? Because I think, you know, what is it that you switch on when you had a long day? And if you can make people think at the same time, then that's like the perfect mix. But we're trying to shoot a comedy, which is sort of a rom-com, in late spring. And then we've got a kind of dystopian thriller that Hope Dixon-Leach is directing, which we're going to do about some designer babies. We've got another comedy that Josh O'Connor, the actor, and Mike Gilbert wrote, which is a coming-of-age thing. We've got a biopic.
So a really diverse.
So it's quite a mix. Yeah, there's not really any hard or fast rules as to what we will and won't make. It's more, do we connect with it? Do we think there's an audience?
Is that a strategy? Because you never know what kind of producer's going to be greenlighting. Or yeah. Finance is going to be greenlighting, so horror is the hot thing right now. Mm-hmm. But who knows, in 2 years' time, it might be coming-of-age stories or dystopian thrillers. Is it kind of wise?
Maybe. I mean, that's not strategy as such, because I think you're right. It's TV's even worse for it. Well, we suddenly want to make 5 Downton Abbeys, and then, oh no, we don't want any more Downton Abbeys. You cannot predict where it's going to go. And it's such a weird thing, because you have these organisations that seem to be characters, but actually there's just people running them, and if the people change, then the tastes change, and you can't try and be one step ahead of people's tastes, because it always changes. So I always think, if it's something that I really love, then I just have to believe that I will still love it in 5 years' time, and hopefully I will.
Other people will.
And you, we definitely do look for the commercial side of things, as in, will it sell? Because there's no point making something if it's not going to sell. But then also, if something's brilliant, but no one's going to see it, then you just change the budget level. And that's what I mean about each script has its different versions. And a script, if the mood is right, that script might suddenly get a massive budget. But if the mood is not right, then it won't. And it depends your urgency to make it. We just want to make stuff. and keep making stuff.
Is that a banner to produce your own writing as well?
Yeah, so we've so the Hope Dixon Leach project Steph wrote and the biopic I wrote, we're kind of, our approach, you know, in a dream world we can be like Shonda Rhimes is in the States and, you know, do both and that would be great. But we also really want to collaborate with other people. The dream position is that we produce stuff we've written with other people and we each bring something different to the table. It's not that we both say, you know, if we wrote something that suddenly some company miraculously wanted to buy for £5 million,
we wouldn't
stop each other. Because also, if you've produced, then you know that process and how great it is to be part of every step. And I think I would find it, I could definitely, you know, I could do it, learn to do it, but it would be really strange to write something and then be like, off you go, here you go, and not have any involvement in that. Because I'm a control freak now. You'd just be strange. You're used to doing it. And
sending,
you know,
it off to sale. What's your writing process like?
My process. It is quite practical in that it's driven by circumstance. In terms of when I write versus producing, it has to slot in with that schedule. So if we're shooting, I can't seriously look at it. When we're in post, I have a lot more time. If it's kind of a development lull before you're starting to put something together, then that's a good time. So they're the big chunks of time. If we're financing something or shooting something, then there's just no time. I tried to get, I'm quite sort of, I do it in intense periods. So if I'm in a film, I'm in a film for completely. And that doesn't mean I won't do 2 hours of emails in the morning, whatever, but I'm not going to write two things at once, or I'll avoid doing that. So I then very much, you know, I make a playlist for that film and be thinking about that film all the time. And I try it with every project. I'm always ruminating on ones before I've written them. So sometimes I'll be in my head for like a year before I put anything down. And then when I feel like I'm ready to put stuff down, then that's when the sort of intense period starts. And I tend to really work on the beat sheet and the outline. Because when I first started, I'd be like, I can just write, it's fine. And then you end up 25 pages in, like, I don't know what the story is.
And also you're probably just wasting pages at that
point. Yeah, such a waste. It's nice to, I do sort of a mix of, I'll write out some scenes because then I feel like I know the characters a bit more. And then do the outline, but you can't just go straight into it. I mean, some people, Woody Allen or, you know, whoever, might be able to sit at a typewriter and just bash out 100 pages. But I feel like I need structure. And the thing I love and enjoy and find easiest is dialogue. The writing bit I find all right, it's the structure that I find really hard, and working out where all those beats and turning points and where they need to come, that's the bit I find the hardest and most frustrating, and I just really, really work on that until I feel like it works, and then the writing is quite quick, so I can just sit down and...
Because you've allowed it to be.
Yeah, but, and I'm definitely not, in terms of when I write or where I write, I'm not one of those people that gets up at crack of dawn and can sit and do it. I'm most productive in the evenings. And that's also led by, again, having a kid, because, so if he has a nap and I've got 2.5 hours to sit in Starbucks and write, then I, you know, use that time. And I don't go on Facebook and procrastinate because I can't afford to. So that's pretty good. I'm not very good in the mornings, so I don't bother. Basically, when he goes to bed or in the evenings, then I can do a solid 3 or 4 hours and we'll stay up until like 1 if I'm in the zone and just... do it.
I guess again, it's finding out what works for you and listening to that as opposed to thinking, okay, well, I'm not doing a 9 to 5, but you know, this is actually when I'm productive.
And yeah, and this is my, I've read loads of books on it, and at first, you know, everyone's always like, well, you should get up at 6 a.m.
Yeah, the Mark Wahlberg routine.
Yeah, get up at 3 a.m.
Work out for 3 hours.
Fish, go for a 10-mile run. Yeah,
sit in a cryogenic tank.
Yeah. But it's just such crap. It's like, yeah, okay, you might be a morning person, but I'm not, so don't force myself. I would get so little done. It's the efficiency thing. I read this book, The 4-Hour Work Week, which is a very extremely short work week. And that's more about being a sort of business owner and letting other people run your businesses, which is not what I want to do. But there's a big chapter on efficiency and being effective, and I totally agree with it. And it's actually really interesting having seen how Ahmed runs his business, because everyone in the office works completely different hours. One guy gets in at 6 a.m. but leaves at 2. Another lady comes in at 3 p.m. and leaves at midnight, because everybody does, some people just do 10 to 6, but lots, they do what works for them. When I realised that I could get so much more done in an hour when I'm feeling awake and in the mood and alert than I could in like 3 hours of feeling shit, I was like, well, it's obviously a no-brainer. But it's quite the hard mentality, the office culture of, oh, who's going to be leaving first? And when you don't have normal hours, I mean, I just saw The Favourite at 12:30 Wednesday.
The dream.
And it's quite hard to not be like, oh shit, I should be doing something. But also when you're self-employed, you work all the time. If you worked at 10, you know, 9 to 5, you wouldn't still be working from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. So you have to kind of be kinder to yourself and more understanding of what works, and then be like, actually, it's okay if I'm not working when lots of people are. It's about the product, right? If the script is written, if the film is made,
it doesn't matter how it gets there.
Who cares when you're doing it?
What is the biggest misconception about working in film?
That it's glamorous. Like 5 nights a year, it's glamorous.
Yeah, around this time.
When you're going to a party or an awards thing or a premiere or whatever, then it's glamorous, but most of the time it's not. What are the other misconceptions about? I think you tend to, and I'm guilty of it, seeing it in other people, so easy to think that other people are doing things quickly. You know, when you see announcements and it's like, oh, this so-and-so's getting their show made, or so-and-so, it's just human nature, but you don't think about 6 years graft or like the show that happened beforehand. That you just think, oh shit, they're doing really well. And like,
yeah, you see the green light.
Yeah, you see the green light. You don't see the rejections and the slog beforehand. So, and if you didn't work in film, I think people are always shocked when they realise how many years work goes into every film. I think people think it's like a done process, and it takes fucking ages.
Yeah.
And just so how many people are involved, and I think that's what, like, my mum still sort of says she doesn't really get what I do, but like, and also that this is a producing thing, but essentially each film is starting a small business and then closing it down when the film's done.
Pop-up shop.
It's a pop-up shop. The film pop-up shop. You know, you register a business, you set it up, you employ people, you have your assets, you make your product, you put it out into the world, and then you're just constantly doing that, which is quite a strange way to live your life, but that is what it is. And for producers, I think just no one knows what a producer is. Well, not many people, or they think it's Harvey Weinstein.
Well, I think there's also a sense that they're at a remove, when actually more and more I've realised that, you know, they're the axis around which the whole project kind of, they're the ones that are keeping those plates spinning.
Yeah, 100%. And it's when people say, well, what do you do? Because everyone knows a director wears a cap and yells, actually, but they don't actually yell, actually. And the director is steering the ship while you're shooting. Absolutely.
You're the one putting the coal in.
Exactly, and you're there from day one, and, you know, also the idea that producers aren't creative is such a lie. Some producers are stronger on certain things than others, definitely. But like, every producer I know is really creative. And often they originate the idea, or they find the book, or, you know, and they're heavily involved in where the story goes and in all sorts of decisions.
Well, I don't think you could or would be doing it if you weren't creative.
No, so. No, you'd be a line producer. Yeah, I think there's definitely a feeling of that. It's not to be trying to step on director's toes either. That's the other thing. It's not, you know, being like the mini-me director next to a director. It's just two voices that can contribute different things, and it wouldn't work if it was just one voice. And I think the thing that my approach, which not all producers, but a lot of producers do, just sit by the monitor the whole time. I don't enjoy that. I sort of dip in and out. Because I think if you were working with a director and you trust them to make a film with you,
got to them,
you trust them. Yeah. Ultimately, you can't micromanage that. And if they have a vision, they have a vision, and you kind of should just let them do it, but be there so that you can be a sounding board. And then I think then directors come to you more, because you're not being like, well, I think you should do this. Because I think if I was directing and I had a producer at my monitor trying to tell me how to block a shot or frame something, I'd be like,
I wouldn't want to work with them.
Tell them where to go. So.
What's a film you've seen recently? It can be a new or old release from a woman director. Do you think people should be getting their eyeballs on?
Do you know, it's really shameful, because I thought about this question, and even films that I thought were directed by women, like Tully, which I saw over Christmas, was not directed by a woman.
Jason Martin.
Yeah. It's so often written by or female leads without a female director. Something I did watch, and this is maybe a really trashy answer, was Blockers.
Yes, I saw that recently too. Kay Cannon. Oh my god, yeah. I love it.
Yeah, Kay Cannon is a genius, because I just thought it was so, again, it was so entertaining, and I didn't think it would be as cleverly funny as it was. I didn't think I'd enjoy it as much as I did.
Yeah,
I did.
I just loved all the relationships. They seem to like match up the fathers with their, or the mother with the daughter kind of very well, and give them each their own narrative. And
yeah.
Lovely.
It was satisfying, you know, goosebump moments, and I just really silly and funny. Yeah. So I like that. And I really like, you know, women should do more big comedies. Should not be just the domain of men. But again, it's another thing where it's, I think it's the doubt is the default position of a woman being funny enough to do that or having the right sense of humour to do that. And I think it's really well at cinemas as well.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of money, so.
And who is someone, they can be a producer, they can be a crew member behind the scenes, a woman whose work that you think we should be paying more attention to?
This is so hard because there's so many. Mm. I mean, literally every producer that is on our roundtable, I'm just constantly obsessed with and like think they're doing amazing things. I mean, Steph as a writer, I think people definitely need to like get on because she's going to be really hot property soon.
Has she written shorts and stuff?
She's written a short we didn't make, but she's had a really lucky, I mean, the script that she wrote that Hope is directing. And I mean, I was going to say Hope, but everybody already loves Hope anyway. Is really brilliant, and you know, she's got this brilliant TV gig, which is sort of almost unheard of because she's got a really clear voice and is going to go really far. Obviously, Steph, but I'm making West on as well, so we can work together. I'm trying to, like I said, trying to do some TV stuff and comedy stuff, and there's a girl called Nicola Wren who we're just doing some like comedy sketch things, but she's really funny and brilliant. It's got a new show coming out at Edinburgh, I think, this summer.
Is she a performer?
She's a performer and writer. She's had a couple of shows at Edinburgh and Soho before. But yeah, she's really cool. And yeah, I think we have to just make an effort to give people... I think TV's doing it more than film, and we need to allow female directors to make stuff.
Is that because there's less risk? You can kind of have a show that belongs to a different sort of brand, have a female director do, you know, one or two episodes.
Exactly. That's what I've been seeing with people is they, you know, there's a lead director and then they do the sort of last half of the block. Mm. Or they come on for series three of an established show to do the whole block. And yeah, there's less risk. And also because TV is so much more about the writer and about the exec producers. Mm. As a director, you're for hire. It's just not your, it's not your show in the same way. Unless you're a film director who's really established, who moves to TV, then it's more ordered. Yeah. But generally, you're just for hire. So it's not the same.
Yeah, even with Jean-Marc Vallée, who
you
feel like he's kind of been sucked into the Big Little Lies thing.
Yeah.
Like...
So I think it's so important that we can allow film directors to make films and not just be like, well, TV's doing it. Because even as film struggles and sort of morphs and tries to figure out what it is with Netflix and everything, I think people do still hold film in a regard that's different to TV. And so that's where all these auteurs are born, in film. They're not born in TV. I mean, name me one that's come from TV. So then they can transition and back and forth, but to get the kind of reputation and identity as an auteur is only through film. And it's not good enough to just have five. There's got to be more, because those five are only making a film every 5 years anyway.
I completely agree.
Oh, another person actually, who's also a French, who's working with Lauren Dunn. It's called Luna. Luna Carmine.
Yes, please. I'm sure.
Yeah, she's wonderful. We both just share an obsession with star signs and shit like that, so she's great. But I've heard what her next short is about, and it sounds brilliant, and I think she's just got an amazingly creative... Brilliant.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. This has been so
nice. Thanks for having me.